And now, the Sustainable Hour, proudly brought to you by City to Surf Solar Plus.
And with a big smile here in the studio, we bid you welcome to the 25th Sustainable Hour. How are you this morning, Tony?
I'm good, Mick. Good.
How's
and
your
yourself?
Weekend? Yeah,
yourself?
Good, good. Yeah. I'm fired up. You know, last night I went to, a very interesting meeting. And, you know, today we're going to talk about responsibility, respect, integrity, and innovation. You know why?
Tell me.
Because these are the four words that are written on the wall at the City Hall, at the in that room where the council meets every fortnight and, you know, discuss important things for the city. Last night was a really important thing being discussed and approved, and that was the budget for the next year.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that. Well, what actually happened?
The budget of Geelong is $180 million, so it's quite a lot of money that they are deciding on, and it's taken them a long time to figure out, you know, how everything should be distributed and what should have more and what should have less and so on. And one of the things that I felt was at stake somehow yesterday at the meeting was the future of Future Proofing Geelong, which is an entity in the council that works with, you could say, with the industries and trying to create innovation and sustainability thinking in the business world.
Yep. And why did you think that was at stake?
Well, because it was proposed that it was going to be cut down.
Okay.
Last year they got something like $350,000, I think it was $344,000, which is actually not very much, but that's what they had for the year. This year they wanted to cut it down to $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy Richards, who's the councillor who's responsible for, you know, the council's sustainability profile and these things, he was a little bit upset about that. He was actually one of the few who didn't vote for the budget. I think because, like in a protest, that it's not the right thing to do. If you want to have a town that talks about being smart and 21st century and all these kind of things, you can't at the same time be cutting down on future-proofing Geelong. That doesn't make sense.
You think it would be going the other way if there were paid income about
Yeah,
it.
Because mind you, this is all about priorities, right? We're talking altogether $180 million, and some of that money, you could say, is maybe more or less, we can't move very much. But for instance, a new thing that's being beefed up is that $2 million is going to be spent on Christmas decorations. Okay, so that we can afford Christmas decorations, that's fine. But we can only give like a quarter of that, or even less, to sustainability in the council.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you?
Not really, but we're on a sustainability show, so I guess that's what
that's
the direction
here.
We're coming from.
But
it would make more sense if they're serious about future-proofing Geelong, that it'd be reversed, maybe. Those two titles.
That's right.
Nothing wrong with having Christmas decorations necessarily, but why cut the budget for? So, is there any insight gained given on that as to why they cut the budget on?
No,
you know,
there was
proofing Geelong.
You know, there was so much to talk about, and I felt a bit sorry for the councillors there. You know, because it's supposed to be that in the beginning of the meeting, there's 20 minutes for where citizens can come in and ask questions.
Uh-huh.
There's a public question time.
Yep.
These 20 minutes became 1.5 hour because of that. There was, you know, actually a full hall. There was lots of people who wanted to ask questions.
Right.
So the councillors, before they could begin to talk about their 180 million budget, they had to listen for 1.5 hours to different questions, really a lot of different questions about traffic lights, about parking, and so on. And
they're fracking too, are you?
And also about environmental issues. That was actually one of the reasons that I went there last night. It was because I thought it's about time now that we raise our voice and begin to ask some questions about what's going on with, for instance, with the fracking, the permission that's been given to Lakes Oil to start exploration drilling in our region. We know that at the moment there's a moratorium, so officially it's not allowed to do anything more than exploring. But on the other hand, who's going to be exploring and put millions of dollars into that drilling project if they don't sort of have maybe an underhand understanding that, of course, if they find something lucrative, something that they would want to frack up, then they're going to do it. The moratorium ends in a year's time.
Yeah. Apparently there's that moratorium doesn't stop everything, every sort of search for unconventional gas. A place called Sea Spray in Gippsland is under threat at the moment from that, and apparently that's fits into the scope of the moratorium. So, yeah, we'll have to watch that one, see what happens. But, yeah, so back to Geelong and the meeting last night.
I just want to mention, now that we are under the fracking, that there's a meeting coming up that we should talk about on the 28th of May.
The gate debate?
The gate debate, and that's going to be an interesting one because it's not often that we actually hear or see anything from Lakes Oil themselves.
Yep.
And in this case, the director has said that he will be in the... in the panel.
Yeah, Rob Arnells, he's the CEO, principal, whatever the boss of Lake Soil will be there.
So if there's a question period there, are you going?
I'm hoping to be at that.
So you'll be able to maybe ask him a direct question about I don't know what his conscience. But sometimes what they're saying basically, and that may be true to some extent, is that they are actually, you know, aware of environmental problems and so on, and they do take care and so on. But one of the issues here is that accidents happen.
Yeah.
So it's even if you take care, that's what we see in America and that's what we see in Queensland, then we have these accidents. Yeah. And do we want even to take that risk? That's the question.
Well, that's
going to be discussed there at the meeting. So, but maybe we should stay in, like you say, in the...
Okay, so what happened last night? What happened at the meeting about fracking?
Yeah, actually, because that was interesting. What did the mayor reply? I asked a question to the mayor, and I started, you know, talking about the economic and the health-wise, the aspects of fracking, the reasons why I think it's not a good idea, and the fundamental reason why I think it's a bad idea to begin with gas mining at this time is because it's, you know, we know it's not good to put carbon out in the atmosphere. This is very clearly said by science, and we're not doing very well at the moment.
No.
So why should we begin to drill for more?
Yeah, after that, all...
That is fundamentally, I think, a question. When we talk about responsibility, which they had written there on the wall, I don't think it's being responsible that you begin to take more fossil fuels up from the ground at this time. We need to switch over. So I was saying a bit about that, and then I was asking the mayor directly, because when he was running for election, we had a questionnaire out, and at that time he said he was opposing gas mining. Unconventional gas mining, which is called fracking, and I was just wondering why we hadn't heard anything about it since then. It half a year has gone now, and Moyne Shire has called for a ban, and Surf Coast Shire has called for a ban. So other shires, other councils are taking action on this. So what's happening in Geelong? This was my question to him, and I must say I think that. I was pleased to hear that, first of all, that he's still opposing fracking. He hasn't changed his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, there were other councillors around the table there who spoke up. Andy Richards said that he personally has family living in areas of Queensland where they're, you know, confronted with the health issues of fracking.
Mm-hmm.
So he opposes fracking for that reason. He knows what it's about. He also said that maybe... around that table, you know, in that council there are lots of business people, and he said something in a polite way that maybe they needed, you know, some education. That's how I heard what he was saying.
Yep.
I felt that he felt happy that we were raising the issue, because this would now give them an extra reason to start looking into this.
Yep.
Especially there was one councillor who spoke up and said he had seen some documentaries on this and he strongly opposed fracking.
Mm-hmm.
So this was three voices coming up, which I think is good to hear. So what happened, you could say, well, not much happened. We didn't get any, they're not making any motion right now. But even so, what seems to be on the way is that they are finishing off now a document called the Environmental Management Strategy for Geelong for the next 4 years.
Yep.
And when that was out in a public hearing, there wasn't a single word about fracking in that document.
True.
But apparently that is being changed now, because there has been lots of input from citizens who have written to the council.
Terrific.
Yep, apparently. And it'll be launched, or it'll be first coming up to be approved in the council, in June, or he said end June, start July. So everything is sort of, I think, pushed a little, delayed a little now, because it'll be more interesting to discuss this when we see what's actually written on paper in that document. I think it's now up to us to just keep an eye open for when it comes up on the agenda.
Sure.
And then we need to go back there and ask new questions once we have seen what's written in what will be the final Environmental Management Strategy paper
terrific.
At the time. So, and another question that came up, we were actually a number of people with environmental agendas, and another question came up about, I don't know if you remember this thing about nature strips,
yep.
and where there was a very strong public uproar against that the council had given an elderly lady who was growing some vegetables outside her house in this public area, saying that either you tear these up or we will come and do it. And like there were 600 people on Facebook who reacted to that when the newspaper, local newspaper, put up a little story about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Geelong Advertiser has written 4 articles on the topic since then. And the good news last night was that the council is listening. And apparently it's even coming to the point where they're going to change the rules and the laws about this.
Okay.
So there's hope for
democracy in action.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how I felt. There's the council listens when people make such statements as yep. as happened in this case.
And there's a message there for all of us, I guess.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, it was also mentioned that there's a homepage. Or it's a Facebook page, which is kind of like a petition for people who want to support that of course we should be allowed to plant vegetables outside in front of our houses if we do it nicely. And I think in 2 days, more than 200 people have been in there and clicking like. So we'll put a link out for that page if it hasn't been done already on our Facebook page, and you can then support the cause, which is about growing edibles. Incredible edibles everywhere out there in nature, just making the city greener in many ways.
Sounds
good.
So success. No wonder you came in here full of excitement this morning.
Well, I don't think it was a success as such. No, because
progress. Put it that way.
Yeah. Well, there was good atmosphere. Similarly to what happened this weekend, where there was the M2M 2014 event, which was an 80-kilometer extreme arts walk. Extreme arts in the sense that it was hard to walk 80 kilometers, but there was all sorts of art happening to cheer you up on the way. There were like stations where every time you came to a new station, something would be happening there. And it was really a fantastic event, I think. One of the powerful things about it was that the council was in it, fully in it. All the councillors were there at the opening ceremony, they were there at the closing ceremony, and it was all done. Speaking of that word respect, there was a lot of respect to the land and all these kind of things.
Terrific.
That we would like to see in that event. I saw coming on the last stretch also politicians. Sarah Henderson came as one of the flag bearers.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that participation of the community that was fantastic.
Yep.
And I recommended the council last night for that as well, because that's something that when we talk about connecting to our land and when we talk about fracking,
yep.
I think an event like that has an influence as well.
Were the Wathaurong people represent at the start?
Yes, they were.
Terrific.
There was a ceremony there,
yeah.
and the elders were part of it. They weren't, I would say they were not on the front line. They weren't that visible and outspoken, but they were there.
Yeah.
As they should be.
Yeah, terrific.
So there was a lot of connections happening between people.
It's good.
I really enjoyed the walk. I did the first 12 kilometers, and then I had, I literally had blood and blisters everywhere on my feet when I took my shoes off. So 12 kilometers was enough for me next time. Next time I'll get some better shoes, I think.
Yeah.
But just in those 12 kilometers, it was great to meet people and talk the way you do. It was a 2.5 hours walk, and the sun was setting, and all these things you talk about on a walk like that. That was a good experience. I can really recommend it. Unfortunately, it will be 2 years before it happens again.
Okay.
So because it's supposed to be like a biennial.
Yeah.
You
know. Sure.
So these were some of the local things. Maybe we should stay in the local and talk a little bit about what's happening in the week to come.
Sure.
So we have a visitor in the program today. Welcome to you, Liza Gleason.
Thanks, Mick. And I'd also like to say congratulations on 25 hours. I hope there are many, many more.
That's right. We can now listen a full 24 hours, 7, one day. Well, let's see how many days we get produced. Luckily, one good news in that respect is that the radio station here will survive. That's apparently the news from the budget, the federal budget last night, that the money that we thought was going to be taken away from the radio station here, so it would have to close down. 25,000 people wrote in to the government and said, that can't be true. This is a democracy. We need these radio stations. So the good news is that we will be here for some time to come.
Terrific.
Anyway, Liza, you came here because you're doing something that relates to environment here this Friday, is that right?
Yeah, it's part of a regular program of progressive independent films that I try to organise in Geelong called Red Cinema. And this Friday has a very particular focus. It's on Palestine and the environmental crises that are ongoing there. I mean, people don't automatically associate the word Palestine or the Middle East with really serious environmental issues, but in places like Gaza and the West Bank, there are incredibly dire water emergencies that are really, really threatening people's livelihoods and their health too.
So how long is that film?
Well, we've actually got two short films. They go for about 17, 18 minutes each, so it's, it won't be a long night. In Gaza, because the Palestinian territory is under siege, it's very difficult to be a farmer, for example. The aquifers are polluted by settlers and Israeli soldiers, so the having access to clean water to consume and to farm if you have a little plot of land that you can access is really terribly problematic. It's there are horrific rates of kidney disease as well from the lack of consumable fresh water.
And how does it work? Is it like a cinema where you just you buy the ticket and then you go in and it's what time and so on? Just to give people a little
idea.
Oh, sure.
Some details would be good. At 6 o'clock we'll be raising the Palestinian flag. We'll have a dinner at 6:30. It'll be a really fabulous halal dinner. And the films will start at 7 p.m. People are just more than welcome to rock up at the door. There's no need to book.
And that's a trades hall?
Yep, trades hall. Entry by donation just to help with costs and so on.
And is this thing about environment something that you're going to have more of?
Well, this year we have really tried to find more environmental films. That's been a real focus of Red Cinema this year. In June as well, after we focus on Palestine this month, in June for Red Cinema, we have a really fantastic film called Solar Mama. Women from poverty-stricken situations all over the world are absolutely desperate to do something to improve their communities, and there's a fantastic program in India that allows women to study to become accredited solar engineers. It's a really low-cost course, and they do this training. They learn how to fit solar technologies in all sorts of places and for all sorts of reasons. And the really exciting thing is what happens when they go back to their own communities.
Yeah. It's coming as an Australian, coming from the country with one of the greatest per capita carbon emissions, it's interesting to see that people in India are coming up with solutions, and it's the opposite to us. Per capita, they've hardly got any. So this is really exciting. I've read about it before, that their grandmothers, most of them, they go back to their communities and create energy, solar-free solar energy.
I think it's something that we need to take inspiration from here in Geelong as well, in Australia as a whole.
Yeah.
How do we create these kind of change makers like these women apparently are now? How do we create these, what did you call them, solar engineers?
Solar engineers, yeah.
We don't all have to be solar engineers, but we certainly need more of them, for instance here in Geelong, that can spread the message. Mm. Isn't that true?
I think...
Have you seen the film?
I've had a preview of it and it is magnificent, but what struck me most is that... it's the poor and the most dispossessed in their communities that are really accessing this training. And in Australia, when it comes to outfitting places with solar technologies, we look at it, it's expensive, I can't afford to do this. How can I make these improvements, these sustainable improvements to my life? I don't see, there are no ways and means for me to do this here, but I think this shows us just what's possible.
That's great. Mm. I think that's
grassroots.
The film.
Grassroots.
Have to be there, and we got to get a lot of Geelongians in and see that film. And what was the date for that one? That's in June?
That's in June. That's Friday the 20th of June at 7 o'clock at Geelong Trades Hall. And you're absolutely more than welcome. As many people as possible, sure thing.
And if that none of that works, the food there they have is delightful as well. So for the people who are in... motivated by food, get along and you won't be disappointed. And then a great film to follow.
Great.
Both of those, this Friday coming and on the 20th of June as well.
Thank you very much, Liza Gleason, for sharing that perspective with us, and expect us to be there.
Oh, please do. Thanks very much for having me.
No problem. Liza, as far as I know, we share a surname, but related.
No, there are Gleasons everywhere doing good things in the community.
The Sustainable Hour, proudly brought to you by Cities of Surf Solar Plus.
Well, we have been going through some of the local news, things that are happening here in our area. But, Tony, there's also, I think we should be mentioning that there's lots of stuff happening around the world. There's good news, there's bad news.
Before we do that, Mick, there's just one last item I'd like to talk about briefly, and that's something really impressive that I saw a 10-year-old from Anglesey talking about her concerns about the future of Anglesey if the power plant there is allowed to go ahead. We've covered this before, but I think we'll try and put a link to Ruby Dingle.
Yes.
There's a YouTube clip, and we'll either bring it on the program in the future on Facebook. But I think it's really important that people have a listen to it and know that kids do care about the future. She's very, very, very eloquent.
And they actually, this group that is trying to stop the power plant and the coal mine in Anglesey, which is called Surf Coast Air Action. Is asking around, calling for if there's other kids out there who would like to do a testimonial like that. And then they will, you can send the video to them and they will put it up on YouTube. And maybe there could be a whole stream of statements like that from that generation. These are the people who are going to live with the decisions that are being made right now. There's a balance there, isn't there, about when do you feel that parents are exploiting their children on one hand, because are they old enough to understand? But on the other hand, when you see this 10-year-old speak like she does, then you understand that she understands what she's saying. It's not she hasn't just been brainwashed by her parents.
And I always ask someone who brings that accusation, it's usually the first thing brought up when kids are exposed. I said, just say, well, when was the last time you were able to get a kid to do something he or she really didn't want to do, that they were forced to do it? So I think that's especially a teenager. And Lucy she speaks far in excess of her 10 years on the planet. Just so much wisdom.
Now that you have mentioned this, I think maybe we should play an excerpt from the meeting that was 2 to 3 weeks ago, because I actually recorded all the speakers there, but I haven't had the time to play them on air. I just played 1 5-minute snippet some weeks ago. Mark Smith opened the meeting, and I think he actually introduced those 250 people in the room there very well to what the issue is and why that the Surf Coast Air Action Group is opposing this.
Let's have a listen then.
The mine and power plants currently employ 85 people. The mine pit covers 419 hectares, and the 2011 agreement allowed for expansion into another 246 hectares, so half the size again roughly. Expansion that Alcoa, however, have chosen not to take up at present. The pit currently goes to a depth of 60 metres. In February of this year, Alcoa announced the closure of the Point Henry smelter, as I'm sure you're all aware, with a loss of more than 600 jobs in Geelong. The closure will become effective in August of this year, and the rolling plant will close at the end of the year. In January, Alcoa made an application to the Essential Services Commission for a licence to generate power from Anglesey and sell it directly into the national grid. This licence has not been granted as yet by the Essential Services Commission, but Alcoa has indicated it intends to sell the coal mine and power plant as a standalone power generator. Thus, Alcoa's 53-year association with Anglesey will be coming to an end. With the Point Henry smelter closing, we believe there's no longer any justification for the mine and power station remaining open. In the 53 years of its operation, there has never been any indication from Alcoa that the Anglesey facility would serve any other purpose other than supplying Point Henry. The 150 megawatts it's capable of producing is not needed in an already oversupplied national electricity market. which will have another 360 megawatts added to it that will no longer be drawn by the smelter when it closes. That 360 megawatts is about a quarter of the Hazelwood Power Station's output. With the significant uptake of renewables in the market, demand on the national electricity market is predicted to fall, not rise. Due to the high levels of sulphur in the coal mined at Anglesey, large amounts of sulphur dioxide are emitted into the atmosphere by the power station, 32 million kilograms per year. It emits three times the amount of SO2 that Hazelwood emits. These emissions of SO2 can be mitigated by the installation of SO2 scrubbers at the plant, but Alcoa has chosen not to install that technology, even though it has done so in similar power stations in the United States. SO2 is a respiratory irritant that's proven to lead to asthma and other lung diseases. The World Health Organization states that there is no safe level of exposure to SO2s. In addition to this, the mine emits fine dust particles that have also been classified as carcinogenic by the World Health Organization. In 2009, Anglesey was listed as one of the 52 most bushfire-prone towns in the state. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything there that you don't know. The recent experience of the fire at Morwell, which we're going to have a speaker talk about here this afternoon, clearly illustrates the dangers of having a mine of such size so close to a community. The mine and power station also lie within the Anglesey Heath, which is a National Heritage listed heathland of international significance. The Victorian Coalition Government has a stated policy of reducing CO2 emissions by 20% by 2020. This plant produces 1.2 million tonnes of greenhouse gas emissions yearly. Finally, SCAR acknowledges the financial support Alcoa has given to clubs and organisations in Anglesey during its time here. This has been both significant and generous. But Alcoa is selling up and leaving. There is no guarantee that any company, whether it be an Australian company or an international company, buying the mine and power station would support Anglesey in the same way, nor that they would limit the footprint of the mine in the way that Alcoa has chosen to. I'd like to finish with a quote from Alcoa, which can be found on the Australian Mining Link website. It says, "Alcoa has always been aware of the need to one day be able to return the lease to the people of Victoria in sound, worthwhile condition and not walk away leaving a great hole in the ground as its legacy. This is our case for closure. We understand there will be people who will disagree with us, but we welcome debate on this issue and the way that it will affect Anglesey into the future." Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
The Sustainable Hour, proudly brought to you by Cities of Surf Solar Plus.
So this was what Mark Smith said at the meeting, community meeting in Anglesey just a couple of weeks ago, and I think he put the finger pretty much on the hot spot, which is what's being debated all around the world at the moment about renewable energy, that we need to close down all this fossil fuel, all this smoke, tons of smoke, carbon that we're putting up in the air.
Well, it's certainly not a good legacy to leave future generations, and the science is against it.
It's crunch time.
It is.
Last year, the good news from last year, the statistics have come now that almost half of all the new power that was put on grid globally last year was renewable energy.
And the trend is up. Each year it's
increasing.
So
that's a lot. That's 43%. It's coming up. And here in Australia, there was just some good news for this month. Came out that wind energy's share of Australia's main electricity market has now jumped to a record high. And when I read that record high, I thought, that sounds high, but it's actually just 5%. But anyway, it's jumped to a record high, and that's that wind share now of the market is 5%.
Yeah. And that's on the back of two different states have got policies actively against wind, and a concerted effort by people with vested interest to talk about the health concerns, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
So it's... Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And when you speak about concerted, I really feel that it must be You know, it's almost like a joke when you hear people, for instance, like the treasurer of this country, Joe Hockey, who states that he says it's utterly offensive with these wind turbines. When he's driving on the road to work, he's passing some wind turbines, and he finds them utterly offensive.
It's a blight on the landscape.
I can't believe that. Why would he be even saying something like that? Why has he never talked about what he thinks when he's passing, one of these refineries
or one of the
power plants? What about all these electricity poles and wires that are scarring the landscape all over Australia? I really think you have a lot of poles here. In Europe, they put them in the ground, but they're everywhere when you look in the streets here and in the farmland. But that's never mentioned. So how come you suddenly want to talk about wind turbines and how they look and what you think about them when you are one of the leaders of the country?
Yeah.
Something concerted, as you call it,
it really talks to the impact that the fossil fuel companies have on the influence they have over politicians. That would have been in response to figures showing that the increase in uptake of wind energy.
Mm.
So he comes out and says that for just some reason, everyone else except the politicians are starting to realise that, and the fossil fuel industry is starting to realise we've got to change.
But it doesn't sound like we're getting the full story, does it?
No.
You know, it's like that these big power companies are not coming out with everything. There was a very good video put on YouTube here last week by something called Power Shop Australia. I really recommend that you watch it. It's 5 minutes and it explains about why it's actually very, very important to get just a few more wind turbines out there, because they can mean a lot for the prices of electricity. It's a little hard to explain here, and I'm not going to spend 5 minutes doing that, but when you see the video, suddenly you understand that it's all about that, you know, in the peak hours, when there's really a lot of need for electricity, then the prices go up. And then you add more and more different machinery to create that energy. And in the end, when it's really peak hour, then they charge $12,000 an hour for the electricity that they're putting out. And the thing is that price then affects the whole market. So if you can get some windmills in instead that can take that peak, apparently that will instantly mean that we get cheaper electricity prices.
Yeah, it's the hottest day, the peak's the hottest day and the coldest day.
This apparently has a big influence on things, and that's also why it's important to talk about the renewable energy target and all the decisions that are being made. We saw the budget coming out last night. This is the time, I think, to say we're happy to welcome Mike. Welcome back in the studio.
Good morning, Mick and Anthony.
You are one of our co-presenters here, so it's great to have you also like an analyst who comes in and gives your...
I was studying my capacity.
Well, no, come on.
You are Mike.
In Geelong, you're definitely one of the people who has a bigger understanding of what's happening when we talk about electricity and prices and so on, and you actually run a company where you're trying to make a business out of that. Isn't that true?
It is true.
That's Green Line Engineering?
Yeah, that's right. They're not an ad for my company. What I'm interested in is to talk a little bit about the budget, in that it's incredibly topical, and what's happened to our climate and energy policies over the last 24 hours. And I think that's a significant thing that people should be aware of. You know, the approximately $15 billion that would have been harvested through the current climate policy, with a cost on pollution, a cost on carbon, will be lost to the budget. And that looks like, if you extend it through to 2020, which is the period for the renewable energy target, then that looks like $20 billion that's come out of the budget. And yet there's a direct action program which is paying people to continue to pollute. I mean, it's just farcical at the end of the day. So this is what people need to be aware of. There's lots of positive things which we'll talk to your audience about in the next 10 minutes or so, but very little came out of the budget that was positive. The only thing that really makes much sense to me is to index the fuel excise to inflation, so that there's people pay more for their fuel. Now, obviously, that's a tough one. I use fuel. My little car runs around, it's 12 years old, runs around getting 7 litres per 100 k's, but there's cars that do a lot better than that, and those cars that are very fuel efficient will be, of course, more highly valued with an increased cost on fuel. And that's a good move.
That's right.
But it's the only thing out of the budget that I can see at this point in relation to climate change and our environmental challenges that is any positive light.
Mike, can we go back to your first point? So you're saying that by ditching all the climate policies that they've had, that there's between now and 2020, there's around about $20 billion that's given away.
Yeah, $15 billion in the next 4 years, and after 2020, $20 billion will be lost to the budget.
Doesn't make a lot of sense,
does it? No, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And look, I think this idea of having a $20 billion future fund for medical research is wonderful, but you've got to balance this with the increased cost caused by climate change, cost to health caused by climate change. I can't remember exactly what the deaths were in the South Australia and Victoria with the heat wave that we had a few years ago, but it was very significant. It was more than the ash, the ash Saturdays, there were fires.
Yeah, and one thing that the climate change does to the world is it brings us closer together. And what makes me wonder is, why do Australians think that they're so different from Americans, for instance? Because right now in America, there's this new report that the government brought out, which is saying, first of all, it's saying climate change is dangerous. And Pentagon and everyone there is taking it seriously. But second of all, is saying no, people are dying from it, not in the future, now.
Mm.
This is the government in America doing this. What are Australians doing? Come on, we have the internet, we have TV. Aren't we in the same boat, so to say? Aren't we on the same planet?
Yeah, I think we've got to really think through ways that we can be more effective as a lobby group, because obviously this is an issue of the coalition government being heavily lobbied by the business as usual model, those with vested interest in conventional power generation. So they've axed, for example, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which has been running at a profit. So these are the company that's providing finance and incentives for people to build the sort of technologies that we need for a modern, clean future. And they have run at a profit, and yet they've been axed. And does that make sense?
No.
So there's more money that's gone from the budget.
Yeah, clearly indicate that there's a small, very powerful group. Now, we knew this anyway. It's no news to anyone here. But recognising what you're up against, these powerful lobby groups, you know, we've got to think through how we can be more effective in lobbying government, in or out of government, to make the changes that we want done.
But, yeah, and let's talk strategy just for a minute in that respect, you know, how we create that change. Because these scary news that coming all out all the time. For instance, this week it came out that West Antarctica is already undergoing what they call unstoppable melting. Mm. And the climate scientists are a bit shocked, because what it means is that now they have to sort of adjust what they thought sea rise would be. Now we're talking about a sea rise between 1 and 4 meters within the next 100 years and so. Things that will really dramatically change our planet. And they keep having to adjust what they have learned the negative way, don't they?
Well, it's it sort of the history of mankind. You get a rise and fall of different civilizations, and they've been significant in the history of mankind. It's usually because there are a minority with a vested interest in business as usual, and we don't respond quickly enough.
So what do you think? What are we to make of that? You know, all the bad news. Is it actually good that there's a lot of bad news coming out now? Because it does make people...
I mean, some people are driven, some people are drawn, and some people need to be faced with a very negative situation before they actually take action and think creatively as to how we can be more effective as a lobby group. And we've got to learn to adapt to the political landscape and make sure that we come up with the right strategies. And
are there any suggestions on that, Mike, on what can be?
We rely heavily on the Greens to do our flag waving for us, which is not particularly fair in many ways, and I've got lots of wonderful friends in the Greens, but they're only representative of a small portion of the greater populace. You know, the last federal election, I think it was 13%. It's growing, which is terrific. But there's also a large number of people that have a social conscience, an environmental conscience, that would otherwise vote for other political parties, but they've got nowhere to go.
Well, this is something we debated last week, a whole hour, that, you know, it's actually funny because the green sustainability thought is when you think about it, it's a very conservative, it's actually extreme right thinking. It's very blue to go independent with your energy and to make money, you know, yourself, instead of paying to some big power plant and so on. So there's a lot of things that are very right-wing, you could say, in this movement.
Yeah,
it's people don't see that. There's been a label that if you're green, you're red.
That is true, but I'm not keen to be drawn towards the left and right politics. You know, we've really got to take things on a policy by policy basis. But the point I'm making here is you've got people like Malcolm Turnbull, for example, who would be very concerned about what the government's doing at the moment, who's right in the centre of the coalition party. He's a popular politician. He's waiting his time. He's the sort of person, he crossed the floor, he lost his leadership, he had the courage to cross the floor, losing his leadership on that issue of a price on carbon. And so those people need to be encouraged, and there needs to be something on the political landscape that caters for that group of people, because you're never going to get the rusted-on Liberal or Labour voter voting for the Greens.
Mm.
The Greens will have an incremental growth, and there will be a bit of a backlash from time to time. But there are some people that are just not going to change. Now, to be effective as a lobby group, you've got to speak through those people as well on these issues, because they want a planet for their children, and they want social justice, and they want a number of other things, but they're just not comfortable with some of the policies of other parties. And so you can't have the left co-opting the environmental, making the claim that this is a left issue. It's not a left issue. It crosses.
Yeah, it's blurred.
You heard Marius Klopas, then general manager of BHP, saying, this is 6 or 7 years ago, that he believed very strongly there needed to be a price on carbon. So it tells you there's a lot of people. I mean, the Australian Business Council, for example, Australian Business Association, quite opposed to what this coalition government's doing in a number of different fronts, not only sort of moving towards abolishing a minimum income for people moving into the job market. They're opposed to that. They say that there should be a safety net for people coming into the job market, and that's a social justice thing that the Business Council is actually supporting, which is quite in contrast to what the coalition are saying. And this cuts through to many environmental issues as well.
But what about if we stop talking about politics and talked about that change should come from, for instance, from the business leaders and only focused on that? Australia's chief scientist, his name is, I think, Ian Chubb.
Mm.
He called last week on company CEOs to take leadership on climate change. And he urged, you know, the Australian CEOs to listen to the science and act constructively, as he said in his
message. That's something that...
Could change come from there?
That's something that captures my imagination to some extent. I think that things need to be done in that area. They need to be better organised. The problem is with CEOs, they're time poor. It's very hard for them to commit to these sorts of projects when they're flat out running a company. But to at least lend their weight to the argument and to be signatories to various different petitions and the like, and to have a peak body like these business councils and CEO groups speaking in favour of the sort of change that we want, the sort of new economy that we need, that's a powerful thing. And so these are ways, getting back to what we started talking about, these are ways that we can be more effective in lobbying. We can't just sort of trundle on marching down streets, waving flags, because it's only a very small group of people that are prepared to do that.
Mm.
And by association, some of those, some people are isolated in that environment. So we've got to broaden out our approach and find other people that have a vested interest in seeing these things move forward in the right way and look at ways that we can capture them.
Earlier today, we talked about that in India. They're making like an educational programs where women are going out, elderly women are going out and becoming solar engineers.
Mm.
And then they teach that to their villages
fantastic things.
And I was just thinking, why is that only happening in India?
Don't we need that here? Sierra Leone, Africa.
But don't we need that here? That we get the solar engineering out, you know, between people.
Well, we've got plenty of capacity in that regard, I think, in Australia. The energy for opportunity to do some fantastic things in sub-Saharan Africa. It's very exciting for people to want to look at being involved or supporting those sorts of campaigns. And they do make a big difference. And so companies can sponsor and get involved with helping people at that level.
But let me give you an example. I think that the reason that we don't hear, for instance, many artists step into this discussion and, for instance, make songs and make, you know, different artistic products about this is because they don't know exactly what to say. They feel confused, like everyone else. There's a lot of confusion around, and I think we know why. You know, there's an interest in that there is a confusion at the moment. But what if, you know, some solar engineering scheme or something came out to teach, for instance, artists? in here, this is what you could say. These are the solutions. You could create songs, films, books, etc. about this.
Yes, there is an organization called Climart, which has got some traction. And my brother's involved, my oldest brother's involved with a couple of projects in that that regard, which is sort of merging some community activity with climate change and artistic representations in sculpture and fine art and music and the like. So that's good. That's effective. And these are all things that can help people feel like they're part of the solution, which is good for them. It's good for morale. But I come back to the fact that we need to think through lobbying at a federal level and being much more effective at it, or else you'll continually be flummoxed by these types of budgets that we've just received at the moment.
I think that realization is there. I can see that at the moment there's all over Victoria, there's climate campaign groups that are finding a way to connect in a network, which is called VCAN,
Victorian Climate Action Network.
And they have like monthly meetings now.
Yeah.
And they're setting up a website. They're beginning to have a mailing list and, and stuff. This is actually new. There has been initiatives similar to this, but it's now it's a new initiative.
Yeah.
So it's sort of coming back now. And the reason for that, I think, is the same as you're saying, that people are seeing a need that we've got to get better at working together. And this is really hard, isn't it, sometimes?
That's right.
Because there and are a thousand different opinions out there and a thousand different voices.
But divide and conquer is the strategy that most political parties take with their opposition. They're looking for that gotcha moment where they trip someone up and they look for dissension between, you know, Christine Milne and Adam Bandt or Christine Milne and the rest of the Greens Party, for example, just recently on the tax on the wealthy. They were really quite excited about that, that she might have a different opinion to the rest of the parties if it really mattered. So that's the name of the game. And yes, we need to be more united and bring people from a diverse background. This is what we've got to get our mind around. There are, it's not just the left or the right or the middle. We need to have clear policies that show a clean, bright future for a very diverse range of people. The mums and dads, you know, the suburbs, where they've got the big screen TV and they've got the car and all that sort of stuff, and the least likely people to respond. How do you actually get to those people? How do you cause them to see this as being a real issue that's going to concern them and their children, their grandchildren?
Right, because
and that's what we've got to think about. That's what we've got to be more effective.
There's probably 20% both ends that are 20% that are
probably less, probably 5%. That's
okay.
A set,
okay, and then there's this broad mass in the 50-60% in the middle.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So they're not going to come out to a picnic or a demo and all these kind of things.
No.
But maybe what then? What?
Well, there are price mechanisms, and this one where the the fuel excise attached to inflation, that's one that causes people to change. Sometimes you get an angry backlash against those sorts of things, but it's up to people to articulate the benefit of it. But more than anything, you know, we need to be able to talk to people about a clean, green, environmentally sustainable and understand what sustainability is. For most parents of primary school children or secondary school children, their children know far more about the issue than they do.
Mm.
And yet they're several years, those children are several years away from voting. So it's an awareness program. And there's lots of different ways we can
And it's about putting the vision up there, what a clean, as you say, a clean world is going to look like,
very,
so we can see it more clearly.
The solutions.
As Steve Jobs said, you've got to believe it before you see it, and this is the name of the game in bringing people in so that we're more effective in lobbying.
Well, it sounds like we've solved it in the sustainable hour today.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you very much, Mike, for coming in.
Thank
and
you
you're always welcome in the program.
Well,
here.
I just love this little show, and it's just really good to see it.
Well,
strength.
I learned yesterday at the meeting, I went to the council, the meeting that the council has, that Andy Richards is apparently our councillor for sustainability. He's listening to the Sustainable Hour, so that's good to know.
Yeah.
Good morning, Andy. How are you going?
And we'll be back next week with lots of more local news and world news and solving the problems in some way. It's we're like the weekly shrink that you can consult if you are worried about the climate and other big issues. We come up with answers here, don't we?
That's our plan. And thanks listeners for listening to us.
We're trying
encouraging
hard. So thank you to Mike Lawrence.
Pleasure.
And
thanks,
thank
Mike.
You to Tony Gleason. Yep. And my name is Mick Eide.
This is the news on 90 94.7 The Pulse.